You can compare what each gospel writer wrote about Jesus and his ministry in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. It's titled Jesus, A Study of the Words of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Jesus, A Study on the Words of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John costs $14.99. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Jesus, A Study on the Words of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Well, I have to admit, it was the first question that popped into my mind. I recently talked with Mark Tooley, who's written extensively about the United Methodist Church, its long battle over human sexuality, and not only human sexuality. There's some deeper issues there, even deeper than the LGBTQ agenda in that church body. First question that popped in my mind is, why did the conservatives, the traditionalists, as they're often called in the media, why did they settle and agree essentially to leave the United Methodist Church and start their own denomination? Was it just to save on lawyers' fees, or what exactly was at work here? And what's the real divide in the United Methodist Church that, at least according to a proposal put forth last week, would amicably split that church into at least two church bodies? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Wednesday afternoon, January the 8th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about media coverage of a proposed split in the United Methodist Church with Terry Mattingly here in the first half hour or so. A little bit later, Pastor Peter Bender joins us for part one of our continuing Lutheran catechesis series on the sacrament of holy baptism and a connection to Naaman the leper being cleansed in the waters of the Jordan. Then Carol Tobias will join us to get a little preview, a little bit of a review too, of abortion legislation for 2020. Joining us to talk about media coverage of a proposed split in the United Methodist Church, Terry Mattingly. He's senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He is founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So I know you've been asked this question many times, but it's the question that popped into my mind when I first read the news about the proposed split in the United Methodist Church. And I looked into the details and I said, it looks like the traditionalists have settled. They're the ones leaving. Why is that?
Well, let me give you an image for this. I was sitting in church the other day, and I hate it when work interrupts worship. You know, you're sitting there. It's the Feast of the Theophany for the Eastern Orthodox. It's the third-ranked feast, you know, of our year. And you're sitting there in the service, and all of a sudden, boom, something pops into your head, you know, about something you've been thinking about for days. And in this case, it was the question, you know, that you had you just raised. And what popped into my head was an image. My wife and I, a couple of weeks ago, went to see A Christmas Carol, a performance of the Dickens classic at the University of Tennessee. And I came home and I got on kind of a Dickens binge, or a Christmas Carol binge in terms of the movies. By the way, far and away, the best Dickens Christmas Carol is, of course, The Muppets. I think we can all agree on that. The one that takes the theology most seriously, has the most religious language, has the Dickens narrator, it's Muppets. You got to go with The Muppets. But anyway, what that has to do with your question is I'm sitting there in church and all of a sudden something popped into my head, and it was the ghost of Episcopal future. And that was exactly what made the traditional side of the United Methodists settle for this deal, if this is the deal we get. And when I say the ghost of Episcopal future, what I mean is that in the Episcopal Church and in different parts of the Episcopal Church, it's still going on. They have been fighting over church properties, trust funds, and even whether what used to be the single most important entity of the Episcopal Church, which is the Episcopal throne, the local diocese, whether a diocese could vote to leave the Episcopal Church and join an alternative Anglican body. That warfare has basically turned into a kind of employment act for lawyers related to the Episcopal Church for 20 to 30 years. Well, I think that what happened with the Methodist, and Tooley has made some remarks similar to this, and so have others. Basically, the thing you need to understand is to look at this at the level of seminaries. I think in many ways, the defining entities of a denomination, for the simple reason that they produce the clergy, and out of the clergy emerge the higher up leaders. Seminaries are really crucial and really important. And the other day, Mark Tooley said something that I've heard others express literally for 25 years. And that is, of the official United Methodist seminaries, all of them, with only maybe one exception, all of them would be openly hostile to traditional small o Orthodox forms of Wesleyan life and thought. I'll always remember when I moved to Denver in 1983, I lived in a neighborhood that was within easy walking distance of the University of Denver campus, and on the University of Denver campus is the Iliff School of Theology. Now, I didn't realize I would be spending a lot of time covering that in the next couple of years as the United Methodist wars began to really crank up. But I did notice that it was interesting. I walked in the bookstore of the Iliff School of Theology a couple of days after I arrived in Denver, and I did what any person of my generation would do who was kind of a conservative Christian of some form or another. I started looking for the C.S. Lewis books. I figured a seminary bookstore might have some harder-to-get volumes of C.S. Lewis. And I walked up, and I couldn't find the C.S. Lewis books. So I walked up to the cash register and asked, and they just all gave this hearty laugh. There wasn't a single book by C.S. Lewis in that bookstore. And so I continued to walk around, and this is 1983. I walked around and discovered that there was at least five shelves of books dedicated to gay and lesbian thought. And a few years later was when I heard a gay student from the seminary say that it was her estimate that at least 40% of the students at the seminary were gay. And this was, like I said, in the mid-1980s. And I had heard before from a former official of the United Methodist Church at the national level that they had done a study of the seminaries and specifically wanted to find out whether churches grew and prospered after hiring or having appointed to them a minister from different seminaries. And this official said that the results were so stark and so depressing. He said that study has been buried and it will never see the light of day and it will never be discussed again. So why am I saying all that? The conservative / traditionalist basically came to themselves and said, we don't want the structures of the United Methodist Church. If the most important structures of the church are the seminaries, none of these seminaries, some of which would be affected by, I assume, would be affected by academic unions, tenure systems, and stuff like this. How in the world would you convert these seminaries at the level of their theological DNA? And if the church's hierarchical system is primarily populated by corporate leaders who have come out of the corporate structure that is the seminaries, how many of the church agencies would conservatives have a chance to actually, that you can't take over institutions like this. You can't walk in with the National Guard and say, okay, everybody here, change your Christology. You know, from this day forth, Jesus is the only way to salvation. Raise your hands. This isn't going to work. And the main thing the conservatives have wanted all along was a chance for the annual conferences, the regional conferences that wanted to be evangelical Methodists and wanted to work with the Church of Africa and wanted to work with the Church of Asia and kind of go with the global emerging church, global South coalitions that exist in other parts of the world. The easiest thing for them to do would be to say, okay, take the structures, please take them. You pay for them now. You pay for them without our help. You pay for them, and good luck. Good luck doing it. And especially if the kind of center-left United Methodist establishment happens to split from the truly radical United Methodist, and I'm using radical, I think they would use the word radical, the left part of the church that truly wants to modernize doctrine and do it right now. Make it mandatory, make it to where local churches have to adopt a liberal approach to marriage and sexuality and other related biblical authority issues, you could end up with a split between the center-left and the left if the center-left doesn't go fast enough. So I feel like I'm rambling, but I've put this all in posts at Get Religion over the years, and one of the most important posts I ever wrote was in 2014, and it was called United Methodist Doctrine. Think location, location, location. And I flashed back to a document that had influenced me a lot, and it was written in 1985 by a sociologist of religion, Robert Wilson, and William Willimon, who later became a Methodist bishop. And at the time of this document, he was known as a conservative. Willimon has now switched to being kind of an establishment liberal on issues of sexuality and quite strongly outspoken against the conservatives and traditionalists. They wrote a document called The Seven Churches of Methodism. And what they essentially argued that was within North America, by region, there were really seven different theological traditions and ecclesiastical traditions that you could see just region by region. For some people now, there has been so much decline in Methodism, they have it down to just the actual conferences. The large conference, the Southeastern Conference, with just under 3 million people. The Northeastern Conference, which used to be huge and very powerful, 1.35 million or so. The North Central, the very divided between city and rural conference in the Midwest, where you still have about 1.4 million Methodists, so to speak. And like I said, really radically divided there between small churches out in farm country and in rural America versus, let's say, Chicago or Minneapolis. The Sun Belt with Texas and all, South Central, about 1.7 million. And then the church that makes the most noise in Methodism, the Western Annual Conference, it only has 370,000 members or so now in a section of the country where the population has doubled or tripled. So I guess you could say at the very least now there are five United Methodist churches here in America. It's been well past time for a divorce for several decades.
Well, when we come back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit about how Terry is evaluating the media coverage of this. The big story, of course, was in the New York Times, but also covered by the Associated Press and other outlets. We're talking about media coverage of a proposed split in the United Methodist Church. Terry Mattingly is our guest, senior fellow at the Overbee Center at the University of Mississippi.
You can meet and hear Mark and Molly Hemingway, Robert George, Albert Mohler, Brian Wolfmiller, Hans Feeney, and Will Wheaton at the 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 12th and Saturday, June 13th in Chicago. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 12th and 13th at Concordia University, Chicago.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Solid, serious, substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death, and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.
O morning star,
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at lutheranpublicradio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We are talking about media coverage of a proposed split in the United Methodist Church. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. We're excited about the speaking lineup for the 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 12th and Saturday, June the 13th in Chicago. Dr. Albert Moeller of Southern Baptist Seminary, Dr. Robert George of Princeton University, journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway, Hans Feeney of Lutheran Satire, and Pastor Will Wheaton of The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, and along for the ride, also Pastor Brian Wolfmiller. You can learn more and register at issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, making the case 2020 in Chicago, Illinois, June 12th and 13th. Terry, let's kind of go out of order here and talk about the New York Times coverage of this. That was the big story. How well did they tell it about the split?
Well, to some degree, we really are dealing with timeline issues here. I understand that newsrooms are not full of ancient people like me, and really whether or not you have anyone in the newsroom who speaks fluent religion beat is a crucial issue on a story of this kind, because this battle has literally been brewing and perfectly visible to all since the late 1970s. To me, one of the crucial dates that people should have in their timelines, yes, this is linked to the New York Times story. In 1980, the bishop of the Rocky Mountain Annual Conference, based in Denver, headquarters on the campus of the Iliff School of Theology, a bishop named Melvin Wheatley, who had appointed a out-of-the-closet, sexually active gay pastor, Julian Rush, later the head of the Colorado AIDS Project and numerous other important things. He had appointed him, and basically he said that I no longer am willing to defend statements that the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. Now, he used that exact phrase because that was already in the Book of Discipline of the United Methodist Church. So when you know that, when you know that Methodist liberals in the West were already fighting the Book of Discipline at that time and were openly announcing their intention to refuse to enforce it. And that's 1980. What sense does it make for the New York Times to come along and say, let me read the exact phrase, a contentious general conference in St. Louis last February, when 53% of church leaders and lay leaders voted to tighten the ban on same-sex marriage, that's true, declaring that, quote, the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching, unquote. They didn't declare that last summer in St. Louis. That has been the teaching of the United Methodist Church for decades, and that teaching has been defended in vote after vote after vote, contentious, dramatic, bitter votes for years and years and several decades now. So for the Times to think that this was something that the conservatives just did misses the single most important aspect of this story, and that is that the Methodist establishment for decades tried to smooth over this fight and hold together the seven churches of Methodism, which even though they had different theology and different social doctrines and different everything, the establishment, of course, wants unity, even if it's unity that actually isn't unity. So what's happened in the last couple of years that is important is that the Methodist establishment has clearly said, okay, we're going to have to compromise and let some people go to the theological left on this issue and let others refuse to go, and we're going to try to keep them in the same church. And that was the one church plan which was defeated last summer. And when it was defeated, I had long conversations with several Methodists here in East Tennessee. That was when the establishment woke up and said, we're either going to have to go with the conservatives or we're going to have to go with the liberals to some degree. We're going to have to work with the liberals, and we can't possibly rebel against the structures of our church. The foundations of the church had already made the compromise at the level of the seminaries, the agencies, the boards, etc. So that's what I meant when I said the ghost of the Episcopal future. I think conservatives, and I think, let's give them credit. If you read carefully, I think it's apparent that there are liberals and moderates of goodwill. They don't want the fight either. They have things they would rather do with their time, their lives, their ministries, and their money for the next 40 years that it would take. I mean, if the Episcopalians are any guide to what happens here in a liturgical and ecclesiastical structure of this kind, you're looking at a solid 25 to 30 years minimum to sort this thing out. And I think there were enough people on the left and center left and enough people on the right that finally said, okay, let's divorce. Who wants what? And the conservatives basically said, we want to be able to start new churches. We want to be able to keep our old churches. We want our ministers to be treated fairly. And we want to be part of the global Methodism represented by Africa and Asia. And that's what they come out of this deal with. What does the center left and the left come out with? They come out with the seminaries, the boards, the agencies. I think they're going to end up with a lot of very expensive urban land in American cities, in blue zip codes. And they now face a very big hole in their budget. If even 25 to 30% of American parishes bite the bullet and vote to leave and take their money with them, what you're going to find is that includes an unusually high number of growing churches and healthy churches that are connected with the evangelical approach to doing church life, and especially to the seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky, Asbury Theological Seminary, which has produced, even though it's not an official United Methodist seminary, it's just kind of linked to it, they have produced a very high percentage of the clergy that are serving in these more evangelical-oriented congregations. Another long answer, but I've only been covering this since 1983.
To your thinking, those who are not so much doing the news, but the commentary on this, you cite David French, Carl Truman has also weighed in on this, and several others. How are they understanding, it's not even a nuance here, how are they understanding that this goes beyond the question of gay clergy and same-sex marriage?
Well, there are a lot of commentators who get it, and the French piece was excellent. And the main thing he noted was that the actual document that came out, which once again the New York Times quoted as saying the heart of this was over LGBT issues, the actual statement from the liberals, centrists, and conservatives, the 9-page separation plan opens with a statement that these groups have fundamental differences regarding their understanding and interpretation of scripture, theology, and practice. In other words, basically all of church life, all of the DNA of a liturgical Christian body, scripture, theology, and practice. Other than that, they're fine. And I want to stress, a lot of reporters need to get their hands on a copy of the Seven Churches of Methodism. It's so prophetic, and so much of what's actually happening right now is in that document, and it's still not getting into our news reports.
Do you have any expectation that the news reports could pick up on what then will be considered a very big subtlety, that there's more going on here than just the fight over human sexuality?
I mean, you're asking me, are the reporters who will be assigned to cover this going to admit that this is essentially about doctrine? Would they even be willing at some point to ask the TMAT trio questions, which I developed while covering the Episcopal Wars and would apply just as well to the United Methodist Wars? A reminder to listeners, the TMAT trio, as we call them at Get Religion, basically say the resurrection happened. It was a real event. That's question number one. Number two is salvation is found through Jesus Christ alone, basically the universalism question, number two. And number three, sex outside of marriage is a sin, period. Not a political issue, a doctrinal issue, sin. Do you think that random reporters chosen to cover this story are going to ask that? And the answer is no. I don't think they will. Eventually, will some of the veteran religion writers who have covered this story over and over, will they begin to dig deeper? I genuinely think they will, and I hope that they will, because this story is going to be so dramatic. The great Richard Osling, the veteran Time and then Associated Press reporter who still writes for Get Religion, Dick Osling said the other day, this is going to be the story for at least 1 year, if not 2 or 3 years. Even with good intent to have a divorce, the bitterness and the pain of this in what many people for years have called the most American church, in terms of the church that covered the zip codes of America more than any other, was United Methodism. This battle is now coming down to every single local church on a 50-50 vote. Now, the conferences have to vote. This will be subject to negotiation. 57% have to choose to join the conservatives, or they stay in the institutional structure. I don't know where the number 57 came along. But it's, you know, the effect there is going to be the people who want to be in the institution are going to stay in the institution. Where this is really going to be painful is those local church buildings where people have been married and buried and have worshiped for decades. What's going to happen to all those churches? The other thing that I think reporters need to watch for is, what do the people who lose the votes do? Do they go to other churches? Do they form new congregations? Do they just vanish? What's going to happen to those people who, in effect, will be disenfranchised out of their local churches? The divorces are going to be at the local level, not just at the national and the global. I think it's actually going to be easier to pull off this divorce at the national and global levels than it's going to be at the local level. And so help me, if journalists go in there and try to pretend that all of these local arguments are just about sexuality, they're missing the drama. They're missing the real story.
So from a consumer's standpoint, a viewer's or reader's standpoint, what should they be looking for in that local coverage of the six or seven churches in their city that are struggling to decide what to do?
First of all, they need to talk to people on both sides. If you do this where you only quote activists on one side and then you run a sentence or two from some tweet or a website to represent the other side, that's just not going to cut it on this story. This is going to be painful. This is going to be emotional and personal. Let me give you a parallel issue from an earlier war. Long ago, while I was in Charlotte, I wrote a story about the local Lutheran church. I guess this is a church in what is now the ELCA. And this was the last church in the city that was holding out and was refusing to go to the new hymnal, was refusing to go to the first stages of the modernized liturgy and the more up-to-date stuff. And I went over and I interviewed the man who was on the committee, and he had lots of good reasons for why they were refusing this hymnal. Good from his perspective, and you know, these were rational things. He was talking about the hymns aren't as solid, the language has been changed in ways that don't reflect the historical nature. He had lots of logical things to say. When the interview was over, we walked out the aisle, center aisle of the church, and we're standing at the very back. And he reached over into a pew, and he took out one of those old, worn-out hymnals, and he held it up, and he started crying. And he said, "I married my wife with this book. I buried my wife with this book. They are not going to take this away from me." Okay, that's the story. And in Methodism, all across America, there are buildings and Sunday school classes and decades of friendships and people who've donated money for memorials for their parents and their grandparents and their dead wives and husbands. You might have graveyards in some places. If you try to go into those situations and say, "This story is all about Donald Trump, politics, and sexuality," you're missing the story. And that story is coming home to just about every zip code in America in the next 2 to 3 years. And local newsrooms had better be ready for it. And boy, it would really help if they hired themselves a reporter who wanted to cover this story and wanted to cover it accurately.
What do you make of comments made by Bishop Karen Oliveto? She's the first openly gay bishop in the United Methodist Church, and she was speaking recently on CBS4 in Denver. And at the very end of her comments there, in her interview on The Split, she said that that is the liberals, the progressives, we go to church tradition and reason for our answers. The traditionalists go to the Bible and pretty much the Bible alone for their answers. Did she get it right?
Well, I mean, she sounds like an Episcopalian from the winning side of the Episcopal Wars. It sounds like the reason, tradition, and experience. But the difference there, I mean, and I'm saying this now as an Eastern Orthodox Christian, the difference is that tradition there is defined and redefined by the modern church. Tradition in liberal forms of mainline Protestantism is essentially up to a vote. And when you vote, you have changed the tradition. The tradition just evolves to fit the spirit of the modern age. That isn't a concept of church tradition that would be represented or would be recognized by most Anglicans in the rest of the world, certainly not by most Catholics, especially in Africa and Asia, and it would certainly not be recognized by Eastern Orthodox Christians who believe tradition is the voices of the early church fathers and the councils, the ecumenical councils who gave us our doctrine. I'm sure she would in some way refer to the councils or something, but the word tradition has a different and more transitory meaning in a lot of those churches. But she also, let me criticize the conservatives for a second. I think she's right that there is a kind of biblicism in the evangelical and conservative world of Methodism that is different from the actual theological content that forms someone like a John Wesley, who went to his grave as an Anglican. But man, that's an Anglican in a completely different era. The wildness of Charles Wesley to be able to break rules and bend rules, he was doing that in terms of ecclesiastical structures and a willingness to create what led to a new movement. Methodism was formed over Wesley's dead body, as the old saying goes. But Wesley was a traditional person on doctrine, and if anything, was judging the Anglicanism of his day for not being conservative enough on the Bible and other things. So this is a part of the seven churches of United Methodism. Some of them have already changed a great deal and have already fit into this new paradigm of tradition that is evolving to fit reason and personal experience in the modern era. On the other side, you do have Methodists who, I would say, have become much more evangelical in the American sense of that word and in the modern sense of the word. And to some degree, they may be different from Wesley in a different way. They may be more congregational in their approach to church government than Wesley was. But Wesley was no theological progressive. Let's just put it that way. It will be interesting to see what these churches name themselves, and that'll be highly symbolic as well. Another story worth pursuing. What hymnal will they use? Will there be a hymnal? Will it all just be projected up on screens in the evangelical churches, just like good suburban megachurches? So many interesting stories to cover here. But I'll return to what I just said. To me, they've got to understand what this looks like at the level of local churches and local worshiping communities and buildings, and tearing that apart on 50-50 votes. You either win or you lose. And if you lose, what happens then? And if you win, how do you pay for the building? How do you pay for the upkeep if 40% of the church is just left? Can you see all the angles of this?
Terry Mattingly is senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi, and he's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He is founder and editor of Get Religion. Learn more at getreligion.org, getreligion.org. Terry, thanks.
Glad to be here.
We continue our series on Lutheran catechesis with Pastor Peter Bender, director of the Concordia Catechetical Academy, after the break. We'll be in the sacrament of holy baptism, this time talking about Naaman the leper being cleansed in the Jordan. Stay tuned. Thanks to the best listeners in podcasting and radio for helping us make budget in 2019. Thanks to your support, Lutheran Public Radio Incorporated has been independent and in the black for almost 12 years. You've heard us say, now only our listeners can cancel us, and we mean it. Thanks for listening, thanks for your prayers, and thanks for your financial support of Issues Etc. live and on demand, The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, and our 24/7 talk and music stations.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
Now that you have packed away the Christmas ornaments and chrismons for the season, it's time for some contemplation. Those chrismons are from the 80s. They're made of styrofoam. The glitter has dropped off and they're being held together with toothpicks. Don't celebrate another Christmas harkening back to the age of glitter balls. Enter the 2020s with Ad Crucem's beautifully designed and lovingly made Christmons. We offer all the old designs and a whole lot of new ones. Visit adcrucem.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Quality, quantity, qualified. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll study pressure to deny Jesus, the beggar worships Jesus, the good shepherd, Jesus lays down his life, and Jesus and the Father are one. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, as we continue our walk through St. John's Gospel on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org, thewordendures.org.
Come, Lord Jesus.
Join the Conterai of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for evening prayer from 7 to 8, Friday night, January the 10th, at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. The Conterai of Concordia Theological Seminary, Friday night at 7 at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois.